Monster Man, special episode, Dark Powers. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular of Patreon backer Sam. If you'd like to be like Sam and get your own special episode, remember that all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for all other levels, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. So Sam, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy the show. If you are noticing some difference in my voice, or maybe more pauses, hopefully that all got edited out, but if I sound a little bit different, that is because at the time that I'm recording this episode, I have got that novel coronavirus, and I am stuck at home, and my throat and my, you know, my whole respiratory whatever is a bit messed up. It's not too bad, I'm handling it okay. I'm just, you know, kind of congested and headachy and sleepy, but I'm doing fine. But if you're wondering why I sound funny, that's probably why. So today, Sam has asked me to talk about the dark powers of Ravenloft. I'm actually not going to spend most of this episode talking about the dark powers of Ravenloft, because there isn't very much to say about the dark powers of Ravenloft. But in keeping with Sam's suggestion, I'm going to try and bounce off the dark powers and talk about the issues that they raise, because I think that they're quite interesting and they get at something to do with the way games are published and played. But first, let's start by defining the dark powers of Ravenloft. So in case you don't know, Ravenloft is a setting, originally just a scenario, but then a full-fledged setting for AD&D, and it still exists today in D&D 5th edition. One of the big hit modules was Curse of Strahd, which is essentially a reworking of the original Ravenloft. And in the mid-1980s, when Ravenloft comes out, it is this kind of Hammer horror style scenario, and it is a little bit different in its tone and sort of in the rules of what can and can't happen to the more typical fantasy scenarios of D&D. And later Ravenloft releases, I believe not the original scenario, but later Ravenloft releases, explained that this was a result of the actions of the dark powers of Ravenloft, the mysterious forces that control this gothic horror-themed demiplane. If you go online and Google the dark powers of Ravenloft, you will find a lot of people being confused about what the dark powers of Ravenloft are, and in particular, wondering whether or not they are the same things as the Vestiges, which I believe are kind of remnants of the deities of the Ravenloft setting. Not sure about that one. Not a Ravenloft guy myself, as I think I may have said. But the reason I think that there is so much discussion and so much debate about what is the nature of the Dark Powers is that they've never really been clearly defined or characterized, because they're not meant to be. The point is that they're supposed to be mysterious. Basically, what they can do is things like choose people to be Dark Lords of Ravenloft and plant them in their domains, which is how characters from other D&D settings like Vecna or Lord Soth wind up being Dark Lord. They can also control how people not from Ravenloft arrive there or return home. And the classic example of this would be bringing player characters who are not originally from Ravenloft to Ravenloft. In essence, they exist to explain why Ravenloft is the way it is, why the setting doesn't work like other D&D settings. Those differences are necessary to maintain the Hammer horror vibe, and so the game just basically says, a dark power did it. The dark powers are the answer to any questions you might have about how Ravenloft fits somewhat uneasily into D&D's planar cosmology. This especially makes sense given that a lot of the time Ravenloft adventures are kind of sidetracks in a normal fantasy campaign. So you're going to be doing dungeons and forbidden idols and whatever, and then for a little bit we're going off to a spooky misty moor where there's a haunted house with a vampire in it, which I recommend, by the way. But the dark powers are not further described or characterized, really. They just embody the tone of the setting and implement that. So the dark powers essentially embody three tricky ideas. I think each of these is kind of an awkward thing to try and do in your game, and the dark powers do all three of them. First, they're a setting element that exists to justify a change in the game's mechanics or premise. Second, they're a setting element that appears to be a tantalizing mystery, but there's no solution to the mystery because it's just a hand wave. And thirdly, they are a power above the setting's deities. So the dark powers are not gods of Ravenloft. They're kind of power gods. They seem to be more powerful than gods, or at least kind of cosmologically higher up than gods. Each of these things has its drawbacks, to say nothing of all three of them. And they can pose challenges when you try to implement them in other games. So a brief aside, one of the reasons that I struggle with things like the dark powers of Ravenloft is that I don't really care very much about providing an in-world explanation for these kinds of genre changes. To me, it doesn't feel too weird to go to a different plane and find out that things are different there. Or to simply have Ravenloft be under some kind of ancient curse that means you can get to it this way and not that way and blah 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 and the mists and so forth. You can think of this as a conflict. It's not exactly this, but you can think of this as a conflict between Doylist and Watsonian readings of a text. I'm sure I've used these terms before, but the terms Doylist and Watsonian come from the world of Sherlock Holmes fandom. So a Watsonian reader looks at the text as a given. This is the text that was written by John Watson. And we will never think about it in terms of what Arthur Conan Doyle was trying to do. We will always play the game. We'll maintain kayfabe and think about what John Watson was trying to do. So if there is an error that creeps into the text, if someone's bulldog suddenly disappears, right? That's the classic example. There's a bulldog in the first Sherlock Holmes story, but not in the subsequent ones, or whatever. It's just because John Watson left it out, or was mistaken, or something. It's never because the author forgot about it. By contrast, if you're a Doylist, you think in terms of the creative agendas of the people who are writing the thing. So this doesn't exactly map onto that approach to game settings, but like, I don't typically feel like I require an in-game explanation for aspects of a setting that don't make a lot of practical sense. I play Warhammer 40,000 games, and it's only when it clashes tonally with the rest of the thing that that sort of thing bothers me. So for instance, I don't mind that there's a bunch of like ridiculous foldy roll in most Star Wars movies. I do mind it in Rogue One, where the whole thing is supposed to be really like gritty and grounded and all about the dirty sacrifices that people have to make in the service of a revolution. And then there's a bunch of rigmarole with the robot arms and all the like hard drives in the big stack. The fact that that's silly bothers me in Rogue One and doesn't bother me in other Star Wars movies, because other Star Wars movies are silly. So to me, if you just said like, well, you can't escape because like that's the premise of the scenario. These people are all cursed because they're cursed. That's the kind of place Ravenloft is. Me personally, I never feel a strong need for a dark power like solution. If you say there needs to be a setting explanation for why the rules work differently, I just say, no, there doesn't. To use another example from Ravenloft, there is a scenario in which Vecna, you know, the Lich Vecna, having been sent to Ravenloft to become one of the Dark Lords, escapes this supernatural prison by teaming up with the evil deity Eos, gets to Sigil, you know, from the Planescape setting, and ascends to godhood. And somehow this creates like weird ripples throughout the universe that alters the fundamental laws of magical energy. And the effect that this has is that it changes the way magic works, and that's an explanation for why magic works differently between AD&D 2nd edition and D&D 3rd edition. This is baffling to me. If the rules change, it's because we're playing a different edition of the game. And if you run into some kind of inconsistency, I used to be able to do this, but now I can do that. I used to not be able to do this, but now I can. You just go, yeah, this is a different edition of the game. Obviously, it's a little bit different. Okay, it doesn't make 100% sense, so just don't look at it too hard. This is for somebody, it just isn't me. So I sometimes have a hard time relating to people with these kinds of concerns because I just don't share them.
James from the future here, just dropping in to say that that is a relatively new thing with me, so I don't want to sound like I'm completely unsympathetic to people who care about the other aspect of it. I have felt that way at times in my life. This is just the place where I am right now.
To use another example from Ravenloft, let's look at these three aspects of the dark powers of Ravenloft. First, they are an in-universe explanation for game stuff. I think that there are games that do this pretty well. So, for example, I believe 13th Age has an in-game explanation for why there are dungeons everywhere, right? It has an element of its setting that explains a common aspect of the adventure game premise. Wolves of God has the same thing. There are definitely games that have in-game explanations for advancement mechanics. So, for example, Werewolf the Apocalypse, rank is a social element of the game's setting, so essentially levels are acknowledged by the werewolf society, although it is possible to advance your character and get good at things without necessarily increasing your rank. It's not typically done. And these are just attempts to put those mechanical elements of the game, because rank is a stat, it affects what powers you can and can't have, on a more setting sound footing, such that like you understand that a pack of rank 4 werewolves
can take on very different opponents than a pack of rank one werewolves. And you don't have to do that thing where you try to figure out the level of another character in an RPG, but you don't want to break character. So you're like, so you've been fighting long? On a scale of 1 to 20, how good of a fighter would you say you are? You know? So I think that people worry about this too much. But if you do it, I think you have to have a pretty light touch. I think it's okay to just say, the ancients decreed that clerics may never wield swords. And someone says, why? You get to go, the ways of the ancients are inscrutable, but their word endures. There is an in-universe justification for this, but it's not really something you want to investigate. It's just an aspect of the setting. One way to do this is just by having everybody be really blasé about it. Oh yeah, the dark powers put a curse on them. Those dark powers always putting curses on people. There are bad examples of this. The second Knights of the Old Republic game, Knights of the Old Republic 2, has a scene in which Master Vrook, a Jedi Master played by Ed Asner, has a go at your character and says that he realized that you were a bad guy, like he knew you were a bad guy all along. Because you get more powerful, the more people you kill. That is, you earn experience points and go up levels. And this is a sign that you are, like, you know, using the energy, the dark side or whatever. Hey, game, don't criticize me for killing people and going up levels. It's your system. So a light touch can produce good results, but perhaps not no touch. No touch gets you the second thing about the dark powers, which is that they are a mystery that has no solution. So a lot of games leave blank spaces, and that's a good thing. Some games are all blank space, right? You make up the setting together, or one player makes it up, or you just play and what it is develops in play. All those things are great. A lot of games give you a rough idea of what's in a place, and then you're expected to fill that in. Terrific. And a lot of games have explicit mysteries that are treated as such. The problem arises when you hang a big sign on something and say, interesting mystery here, but there actually isn't an interesting mystery. There's no way to understand it. And it's particularly irritating when it is something that the player characters have a very strong reason to be interested in. If you wake up on the misty moors of Ravenloft with a bunch of yokels telling you not to go up to the old castle because it's haunted, one of the first things you're going to want to know is, how did I get here and how do I get home? And the answer to both of those questions is linked to the dark powers. So player characters are strongly motivated to investigate what the dark powers are, find out more about them, but there is nothing to find. Now, of course, you can make something up. That's whatever. That's fine. But there's no reward to it. You won't be able to change anything by finding out what's going on with the dark powers. So this has the potential to be kind of unrewarding or anticlimactic because the game intentionally piques the player's curiosity and then doesn't provide a response to that curiosity. I think it's okay to provide a very simple answer to the question, but if you're going to provide a simple answer to the question, then you have to just provide it. It is no good having people go through a bunch of rigmarole to find out something that's not useful. It's bad pacing, if nothing else. Players are going to spend a lot of time trying to find out what the dark powers are, and they're not going to get a satisfying or interesting answer. And of course, the third thing about the dark powers is that they are a power above the gods. Now, the idea that there are sort of cosmic forces beyond or behind the gods is one that you can find in a variety of media. I'm thinking, for instance, of the new gods in DC Comics. Right? The new gods are a lot like D&D gods, as I have discussed on previous episodes of Patron Deities, or maybe of this show. The thing about the new gods is that they are very powerful inhabitants of the cosmos, but they're not really its rulers or creators. Right? They are superhumans, but they're not all powerful, and there is a layer of cosmic mystery behind them. The mystery of the source, this strange energy that provides knowledge to the leader of the good guys, High Father, and would become an unstoppable weapon if the leader of the bad guys, Darkseid, were to wrest control of it. But the reason that I feel like this is a little bit different, you know, in like a Jack Kirby comic than it is in your D&D game, is that in the Jack Kirby comic, the new gods are protagonists. So the enigma of the source is meant to motivate them and to characterize them. The wise leader High Father seeks to commune with and empathize with the source to absorb its wisdom, whereas the cruel tyrant Darkseid seeks to bring it under his domination. But if the gods are not the protagonists of your game, they're just elements of the setting, then it has less importance what they are motivated to do, especially if it doesn't involve the PCs. Although you could say maybe like the game's source equivalent, the Dark Powers or whatever, have got some barrier against the gods. There's something that prevents the gods from finding out what this thing is. But maybe a sufficiently motivated mortal could do this. That's a fun idea, the idea that the gods might attempt to manipulate mortals to sneak around in areas that gods specifically can't enter. However, that's not a very Ravenlofty idea because it doesn't really fit with the gothic horror concept of Ravenloft, right? Ravenloft is, I mean, maybe not even gothic horror, gothic fantasy. Whereas that's more of a cosmic horror idea or a cosmic something idea. The thing you have to ask yourself is, what are you trying to achieve when you include gods behind the gods in your game? Perhaps trying to maintain a sense of mystery in a world where the cosmos and the gods are pretty rigidly defined. That's true of the typical AD&D game. Gods have defined roles, they have X number of hit points, they have certain powers and items, and they're very, very powerful, but they're not transcendent or ineffable in any way. They're specifically effable. There is a book that's all about effing them. So in that situation, you might want to have something that creates a little bit more of a feeling of cosmic mystery. So yes, here are the gods, but beyond them is an infinite unknown, blah, blah, blah. Fine, nothing wrong with that. You may be attempting to escalate the power level of a campaign where the PCs are able to challenge the gods, right? That makes sense. As PCs get very powerful, they may be able to take on the gods. You want them to still feel a little bit humbled by the scope of the cosmic thing, so you introduce a tier of gods behind the gods. Or in a sort of twist on the explaining a game mechanic thing, you may be attempting to explain the presence of rules that even the gods have to obey. Although it doesn't involve a layer of gods behind the gods, an example of this would be the Cosmic Compromise in Glorantha, where there are actually certain rules that the gods are pledged to obey, and that if they were to violate them, or when they do violate them, this has huge consequences for the setting, and creates certain immutable rules that kind of affect, well, not gods, but everybody else. Like the passing of time. So it is something you can do in a game, but there are definitely limitations on it. And the first, and perhaps the most important, is that you can only do this once. Once you have unmasked the ultimate power to discover the real ultimate power behind it, you cannot do it again, or it's going to become ridiculous. It's going to be a little bit like Supernatural, that TV show. I never really sat down and watched it, but I know there were like a dozen seasons, and every time they saved the world from some apocalyptic threat, along would come a bigger and more apocalyptic threat. And the thing is that after a while, it just loses its impact. You just start to get a little bit tired of it. The problem is that there is one set of incentives which push people to make the show in terms of its, you know, viewership and so on, right? Like, the show is popular, therefore it must continue to be produced. And there's another set of incentives, you know, good storytelling, that say this show should end. The second thing to avoid when using gods behind the gods is that you cannot use it to devalue PC achievement. If the PCs think that they have slain the diabolical master, you may create a sense of anticlimax if you reveal that that diabolical master was only a pawn of an even more masterful and diabolical master. This is a very fine line to walk because you want to make sure that the players are challenged, but you don't want to take away their accomplishments, which feels unfair. Oh, you beat Orcus? Well, it turns out Orcus is nothing. Behind him, there's Cthulhu. To go back, as I often do, to comic books, I don't know how much you know about the history of comics continuity, and I don't want to get into the deep waters of it all, but essentially, in the 1930s and 1940s, DC Comics published Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, and lots of other superheroes that were well known, the Atom and the Flash and Hawkman and so forth, Green Lantern. And then in the 50s and 60s, you know, all of these had been canceled except for Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman. In the 50s and 60s, they brought new versions of those characters back. And this started to, like, raise weird questions among people who cared a lot about comic book continuity. Is the Superman who's flying around Metropolis in the 70s the same guy who was fighting the Germans in World War II? Does he remember those adventures? If so, isn't it a little weird that he knows the Flash, Barry Allen, and he also knew the Flash, Jay Garrick? Although I don't know how much Superman and the Flash crossed over because they were different publishers at the time. It's not important. Anyway, are these all happening in the same continuity was a question that a certain type of fan was asking. And so was created the idea of, although this is not what they called it at the time, a multiverse, essentially a set of worlds. So there was a Flash of Earth 2, that was the guy from the 40s with the kind of winged helmet, and there was the Flash of Earth 1, and that was our Flash in the red suit from the 60s, well, the 50s, but, you know, whatever. And this is an okay idea as long as you leave it at that. The problem is, the storytelling possibilities in these multiple worlds are too rich. What if there was another world where the Nazis won World War II? What if there was another world where all the good guys were bad guys and all the bad guys were good guys? What if there's another world that didn't have superheroes at all? Etc., etc., etc. But eventually, you wound up with this weird situation where, I don't know how to describe it. It just, the continuity became so complicated that DC decided to have what was called the Crisis on Infinite Earths, and in story, sort out the continuity. So not just say, hey, we're not going to publish all these stories where there's an old Superman and a young Superman. It's going to be just young Superman, and he started being Superman in the 80s, and all those comics that were published in the 40s, well, they're fun to read, but they're not part of his history. They didn't say that. Instead, they came up with an in-setting event that altered the metaphysics of the universe as a way of reconciling their continuity. And then they did it again and again and again, over and over again, from the 80s till now. That's a very long-winded analogy, but I guess what I'm saying is this. The difference between Ravenloft and Greyhawk is a meta difference. It is an out-of-character difference. They are games in different genres. James Bond nominally exists in the same world as George Smiley. Theoretically, they coexist because those stories are both theoretically set in our world, but they obviously cannot interact because they're different. And you cannot put into your setting an in-setting explanation of why Smiley has like tense conversations with people in cafes and James Bond has a car that turns into a submarine. There's some kind of super science field being operated by Q that gives James Bond all kind of weird powers, and this has been going under Smiley's nose the whole time, and he just didn't notice it. It doesn't work. They don't fit together. I'm sure I've said this before, but I always say it. There's no such thing as an in-character solution to an out-of-character problem. You can't stop that player at the table from being a pain in everyone's neck by dropping a rock on his character, because it's the player who's being a pain. By putting an in-setting solution to the difference between genres, all you're doing is hanging a sign on it, drawing players' attention to it. So if you feel like you need a solution, then the dark powers are as good a solution as any, I suppose. But they need to exist with a light touch, or else we're going to get into meta territory. The real solution is, yes, this game can handle multiple genres, yes, they sit together somewhat uneasily, but they're fun still while you're playing them, and while it's not perfect, you just do it anyway, right? We all managed to accept that, or maybe we didn't, that Deep Space Nine has all these like sad episodes about discovering that your family members were collaborators during the occupation, and then it also has silly episodes about baseball, and allegorical episodes about being a science fiction writer during the Great Depression. And it doesn't really make a lot of sense when you think about it, but the show would not have been improved by someone coming along and saying, hey, let's think about this a lot. So the dark powers are as good a solution as any. You can mention them and just say, me personally, I would say planes have personality. Planes are not alive necessarily, not conscious necessarily, but they just kind of have personalities. And the rules in each plane are a little bit different from the rules in every other plane. And if you're going to travel between planes, you're just going to have to accept that as part of life. Okay, I just created Torg, but I feel like a lot of this comes from a sort of institutional lack of trust in player buy-in. Because in reality, players are happy to go along with things, for the most part, in my experience. And the ones who aren't, maybe will be happier at a different table. Not in any kind of judgment, but just they may not enjoy playing this game. They won't enjoy it more because there's some kind of cockamamie in-character explanation. So just say, yeah, guys, this one's the gothic horror one, and it's going to follow some kind of gothic horror-y rules. How did all these people get here? Dark powers. And then every time they go talk to some sage about it, just say, little is known about the dark powers. And maybe they'll get the picture. All right, so that's all I've got to say about the dark powers, and I really should have come up with that thing of calling them the dark powers earlier on in the episode, but I didn't. So Sam, thank you very much for your continued support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. It was a bit abstract, but I still thought there was some okay stuff in there. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Sam and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we are going to be taking a look at our next to last set of monsters from Monsters Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, 2nd edition. So I hope that you will all join me then for Monster Man. A show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis.
Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.